From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet David Alan Greer, one of the stars of one of the funniest shows on TV, In Living Color. He'll tell us about some of the characters he does, like the blues singer Calhoun Tubbs, the homeboy film producer Clavel, and a swishy movie critic in Men on Film. Also today, remember the stealth fighter that Dick Cheney canceled in January because of its prohibitive cost overruns? Now the Navy has resurrected the program under a new name. We talk with Tim Weiner, author of a book about the Pentagon's secret budget. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles country singer Charlie Rich. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Albania's Communist Party is claiming victory following Sunday's historic multi-party election. Pierre Vickery reports that although both the president and prime minister have been heavily defeated, the Communist Party has won an absolute majority in the National Assembly.
In many ways, Sunday's elections have produced the worst possible result for Albania's fragile new democracy. The opposition Democratic Party scored sweeping victories in almost all of the country's urban centers, but was heavily defeated in the countryside. The progressive communist leaders, who stood mainly in the cities, have been decimated. But the party as a whole will control two-thirds of the seats in the 250-seat National Assembly. President Ramiz Alia suffered a crushing defeat, but will remain Albanian Communist Party leader. The Prime Minister, Fatos Nano, has lost his parliamentary seat. Opposition leaders appear stunned by the size of their electoral defeat. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in the Albanian capital, Tirana.
USAID officials said today that a special team will be sent to Albania this week to determine that country's humanitarian needs. The assessment is being made at the request of Albania's foreign minister and the leaders of the opposition Democratic Party. The team, assembled by the U.S. Agency for International Development, will focus on medical and food needs. Team members are expected to spend about 10 days in the country. Albania has been suffering from a three-year drought that has reportedly led to widespread food shortages. In a report to the United Nations, Britain has been accused of a flagrant abuse of power over the detention of Iraqi and other Arab nationals during the Gulf War. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
The report by the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, a British human rights organisation, says that the government was in breach of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights when it detained about 180 Arabs living in Britain as a threat to national security. The covenant prohibits arbitrary arrest or detention and requires that a detainee is told why he's been arrested and is able to challenge the decision in court. The report says that Britain didn't meet these requirements, and the fact that the detainees were released en masse at the end of the war shows that they were being held arbitrarily. The report will be, amongst others, including a government submission, being discussed today at a special meeting of the United Nations Human Rights Committee to examine Britain's record. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
Stock prices fell today on Wall Street, sinking in post-holiday trading on the news that industrial activity in February showed only a slight improvement. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 33 points to close at 2,881. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 144 million shares. This is NPR News. Kuwait's major opposition groups joined together today to demand that the country's ruling family move toward democracy and set a date for parliamentary elections. Six groups, ranging from leftists to religious fundamentalists, signed a manifesto calling for greater freedom. Their demands include a free press, an independent judiciary, legalized political parties, and measures against government corruption. The manifesto also called on the government to bring back the Kuwaiti constitution that was suspended in 1962. At the same time, President Bush wrote to the Emir of Kuwait, Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah, calling for elections and greater political pluralism. North Dakota Governor George Sinner has vetoed an abortion bill passed by that state's legislature. The bill would have been one of the strictest abortion measures in the nation. Renee Albrecht of Prairie Public Radio reports.
The bill would have banned all abortions except in the case of rape, incest, or a danger to the mother's life. The bill required that a woman seeking an abortion because of rape must report the rape to police within 21 days. There was no time limit specified in the case of incest. Governor Sinner says there is a wide variety of opinions on when life begins, and government should not impose the will of one group on the rest of the state.
It is this fundamental decision to say that we have our belief and we're going to impose it on everybody else, that the separate human person with intellect and will exists at the moment of conception. That's what I object to.
The North Dakota House and Senate could vote to override the governor's veto. That would take a two-thirds majority in each house of the legislature and is not considered likely to happen. For National Public Radio, I'm Renee Albrecht in Bismarck, North Dakota.
Martha Graham died today at her home in Manhattan. She was 96. Graham was one of the most influential figures in the creation of modern dance. Her work in dance has been compared with the painting of Picasso and the music of Stravinsky. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the funniest shows on TV is In Living Color. A lot of viewers have come to think of it as a younger, hipper, blacker answer to Saturday Night Live. The show was on Sunday nights on the Fox network. My guest is one of the stars of In Living Color, David Alan Greer. When the show's creator, Keenan Ivory Wayans, invited Greer to join the cast, Greer turned him down several times.
Because this was at a point in that year, I had auditioned for almost 50 pilots. And it was at a point in my career where the casting directors would call, if it was like for an albino midget, it would be like 15 albinos and then me in the room. I was like the... I don't know. I was that one actor like, hey, we may go a different way. And I auditioned for everything that year. I just didn't think this was right for me or whatever. I don't know. You know, my ego, whenever I try and make a decent decision, it always blows up in my face. But anyway, so my wife talked me into it. Kim Wayans talked me into it. And I went in and I auditioned. And it wasn't really an audition. It was an improv. And I had so much fun at this audition, I didn't want to leave. We just improv for like an hour and a half, and Keenan was there, and he would bring in groups of people, and it was so much fun. He asked me to do it, and I said, yeah. You know, finally, I said, yeah. And I'm really glad I did.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, too. Let's talk about some of the characters that that you've done, some of the recurring characters that you've done. Let's start with Clavel. You and Tommy Davidson play these two guys who are always trying to pass themselves off as film producers. Describe the character.
Well, we call them the BS brothers for obvious reasons. But these are guys, these characters came out of the fact that literally when this show hit, I don't think, television is so immediate that we came out, we did the pilot. And when I would go and do other work, because we waited almost a year before we did the show, everyone had seen this pilot. As a matter of fact, the show got reviewed before it got picked up by Fox. It got a review in like Vanity Fair. Because someone had started making copies of the pilot, bootleg copies, and they were all over the country. Everyone had seen the show, and they loved it. So when the show first went on the air, there was no security, really, and people were just wandering around the halls, and you would always see these guys. I mean, these kinds of guys that were always hustling, always trying to get, you know, get over. And they would, like, burst into Keenan's room when he was getting made up. And, you know, with the cards and everything. So these are real people. And any time you come to see our show, you will see them in the green room. Actually, the BS brothers.
Oh, this is it, homie. This is the green room. Is Madonna down here somewhere?
I'm Madonna's manager. She's on stage. Can I help you?
The man himself? Look here, homie. I'm Clavel. Now, I know Madonna must have mentioned me because we go way back. My cousin Boudreaux delivered some flowers to a guest house one time last year.
No, men on film. This is a sketch that recurs that you and Damon Wayans starring this one. It's a kind of takeoff on Ebert and Siskel, but you're two very swishy gay critics.
Yeah.
How did this one come about?
Like that, those characters started out, as they were going to be two brothers. You know, they were going to be Dickie and Donnie somebody. And a lot of people tried it. You know, a lot of times we'll read it if it doesn't work with one actor, you try it with another one, and, you know. So they passed it around. And when Damon and I read it, initially it wasn't the sketch that you see. Initially, the films that we reviewed had really nothing to do with our personal points of view. And so we changed it around, and it really clicked. When we did that for the pilot, the curtain came up, and the audience just went insane. And by the end of the sketch, I knew it was going to be a big thing, but I didn't know it was going to be that big.
Now I'd like to talk about a film I've been anxiously waiting to see, Great Balls of Fire.
I ain't going to touch it. But the title alone gets two snaps up.
About some films that are soon to come out on video. First up is Dangerous Liaison, starring John Malkovich and Glenn Close. Mm. You know, John Malkovich is like every moviegoer's fantasy. I find myself just alone at night just thinking about his intensity.
Yeah.
What you think of Glenn Close?
Oh, I loved him. And I really have to admire the producers for daring to cast a man in that role. I mean, that really made the picture for me.
Hello? Glenn Close is a woman.
Clutch the pearls. What a sneaky thing to be.
Well, looks like we're almost out of time. Would you join us next week when we talk about Mel Gibson's Lethal Weapon?
I hope it's loaded.
You crazy.
You know, I should mention here that this sketch has been criticized by some gays for being a homophobic, stereotypical. Do you think it's offensive, and do the criticisms bother you?
No, the criticisms don't bother me because we've gotten like twice, three times as many letters from gay viewers that say they love the those characters and that please do more, do it every week. Why aren't you doing them? Why did you take them off? And that kind of thing. So, and I also think in comedy, you know, if you get no criticism, if everyone's happy, then you're not doing your job, you know. I think that we do not criticize a lifestyle and we don't pass judgment on a lifestyle. It is definitely a caricature based on, you know, real people. But we didn't single out this particular group. We beat up on everybody. But I don't think it's a malicious thing. Our humor is not a malicious thing, you know. Absurd, grotesque, bigger than life, yes, but not the kind of thing that you don't deserve to live. You're the reason why, you know, our society's screwed up. We don't do that kind of stuff.
Now, a character you've done a lot is an old blues singer, an old blind blues singer, or is he really blind?
Yeah, right. Calhoun Tubbs. Calhoun Tubbs is like the worst blues singer in the world.
Thank you very much. All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Calhoun Tubbs, known to my friends as Hard Fingers. See, that's because back in 1947, I once played the guitar for over 36 hours straight. For no reason at all. That's right. I wrote a song about it. Like to hear it, here go. I play guitar for 36 hours. I don't read it all. Thank you very much. You know, I'd like to welcome y'all to my 75th anniversary show. That's right. 75 years in the business of the blues. Still trying to make it. I wrote a song about it, like the kid did go. 75 years of show business, and I'm still trying to make it.
I was doing a movie in Canada, and my wife and I, we went to this little bar, and I said, wow, you know, this old blues guy's there. And there are all these white people were packed in this little coffee house, and this guy had to be the worst. He couldn't play guitar. He couldn't sing. You know, his songs were terrible. And yet there are all these kids, you know, like all these college students were packed around him like he was a messiah, you know, like this guy was a real blues singer. And we were in the back laughing our heads off, man. So that was the idea for Calhoun Tubbs, this guy who's really terrible, a terrible blues singer, but he's got a lot of heart.
And people fall for him.
Yes, yes, yes.
No, another character I like a lot. This was not a recurring character, but this was a sketch you starred in called John's Sidekick.
Oh, you know, I loved that sketch. And we
yeah,
kept
I loved
trying
it too.
Yeah, we kept trying to bring him back, and we probably will next year, but we just couldn't find the right thing. And John's Sidekick is just, you know, just what it is. It's like in every action-adventure movie, you know, there's always the white guy is always the one who gets shot, he takes the fall, he beats everybody up, and, you know, he has a black sidekick who never does anything. You know, he never gets the girl, but he's always there as the best friend, you know, the generic asexual sidekick, and that was our tribute to him.
Yeah, and as John's sidekick, like you wouldn't cross, you know, against a red light. You know?
Right, yeah, yeah.
You have to play everything by the book.
He follows a book by the book. John's sidekick.
Yeah, I like that, man. As a matter of fact, when we were shooting that in Los Angeles, the guy was chasing me, and the police pulled up. You know, they screech up there, and it was really funny, you know. So the guy had to put the gun down, and we all, you know, were up against the fence and the whole thing.
Oh, jeez. So what happened?
Nothing. We got out alive. You know, thank God there was a camera there, but it was, you know, we knew it was going to happen.
Really?
It was so strange. We did know. Yeah.
How did he treat you before he found out that you were shooting something?
Ah, man. You know, there was a camera there, you know, and there's two black guys. We both have guns, but there's a camera there. So it would make sense to you that we're not, like, robbing anybody. But, you know, I'm just glad the camera was there. Or else it could have been a long night. You may have been looking at videotapes of me instead of Rodney King. You know.
Now, one wonderful thing about the show is that because there are so many black performers in it, you can spoof characters and ideas that really whites couldn't touch. Because it might be considered racist if whites took on kind of black characters like that. Two, they couldn't do it just physically,
yeah.
And three, they wouldn't know enough. Do you know what I mean? There's some kind of inside humor in there that. Because you're doing people who come from your life, you know, and people who
right,
you know.
Right.
It's based on people who, a lot of the characters are based on people who you know.
Right.
So you get inside it in a way that I think white comics or white actors couldn't.
Well, I don't think they really think about it, you know. It was like when I did Soldier's Story, when I first saw the play a few years ago, it was great to see more than one black voice on stage. You know, there were good people, bad people, people who you didn't agree with, people who you totally agreed with, people who were like out in left field. And I think that's what you get when you have more than one black voice, or more than one Hispanic voice, or more than one Asian voice. Then you can represent a multi-textured and multi-layered community. But when you have one ethnic minority, then that person has to speak for like 400 years of oppression. And you know,
right.
He has to please everyone, and usually the minority community is dissatisfied, the performer is not served, the piece isn't served, and everyone comes out frustrated because it's just hard to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So whenever you have like one black actor or one woman or, you know, one Asian and in a mixed, you know, all whites or whatever, I think it's really hard to come out successfully.
My guest is David Alan Greer, one of the stars of In Living Color. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. David Alan Greer is my guest. Now, the Wayans, I think, grew up in a housing project, whereas you come from a much more prosperous family. Your father was a psychiatrist. He was the author of the book Black Rage.
There's a lot of pain there. Excuse me.
Does this affect the kind of roles that you get on the show, coming from a more middle-class background?
No, I think it affects the way people perceive you. You know, if they don't know that about me, then you know, it doesn't affect that. But what affects it more is that I went to an Ivy League school, so I always get Yale, you know, this Yale thing. Oh, you went to Yale, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And because I'm a, quote, classically trained actor, then I get teased a lot, you know. But, you know, I just give them peace of my mind and iambic pentameter and all that stuff. It does sometimes to them, but, you know, I feel like I've proven myself. I feel like I've proven my versatility. Sometimes I wish I could play more, you know, street people or whatever, you know, because I know I have the capacity to do that as an actor, you know, but I think it's more the way you carry yourself or something. You know, in this business, you're only perceived by the last thing you did. So because, you know, before I did a sitcom, I did a sitcom a couple of years ago called All Is Forgiven for NBC, and my agents would try and submit me on comedy projects, and they said that the casting director said, oh, but he's not funny, because they'd never seen me be funny. So therefore, they thought that I wasn't funny. I'd only done serious roles. So that's the way it is, you know? And now, because I've done this comedy stuff, I think I have to reestablish myself in a serious mode.
Right.
You know, because now the cast directors are going, oh, he's funny, you know, that kind of stuff. So you're always reinventing yourself. Always, it seems like.
Now, I have to ask you about your father's book, Black Rage. It's a book I've seen, but I've never read. What's it about?
Well, this came out in a time, like I was a real little kid, and it came out in a time in the 60s, you know, and it was black consciousness and that kind of thing. So what it basically was, it was like, it talked about the state of the black family in America, the fact that a lot of families in America, in urban America, are matriarchs, and the reasons why that was, and, you know, what brought us to this state as black people, that kind of thing. And so it got a lot of attention, and for that time, it was a big deal.
What was it like for you to grow up in such a racially conscious home?
Well, you know, my parents were divorced when I was 10. Oh. And when he wrote the book, he was in San Francisco. I just remember visiting him, and he would take us by, like, the Berkeley Draft Board, and he would take us to Haight-Ashbury and Telegraph and all that stuff, and the Black Panther headquarters. This was like his tour, you know, with us as real little kids. And that was really exciting. You know, growing up in Detroit, it wasn't like, you know, we talked in Swahili at breakfast. It was more like that was the environment. I mean, all around you in any urban city in America, if you were black or white or whatever, that was the mood in the air, you know. It was really boring. I mean, I don't really consider myself a child of the 60s because I was so young I couldn't participate. I'm like a child of the 70s. So my thing is apathy. That's what I remember from high school. You know, just people sitting around going, wow, man, Hendrix is dead. You know, so.
So what else does being a child of the 70s mean to you?
Platform shoes. And that is the one great thing on the show that we get to spoof the 70s. On my character is Clavel, and every time I played him, I always wear these platform shoes because for me, that just sums this guy up. Platform shoes and granny glasses.
Right. You went to the Yale School of Drama.
Yeah.
And you got your start in theater and in films, and you were actually in a couple of musicals. You were in a musical based on the life of Jackie Robinson. You played Robinson,
yes.
And I imagine had to do a lot of singing, Broadway
kind
of singing.
Yeah, I did. I can sing. I was in there, and that was my first job. It was my first job right out of school. As a matter of fact, they stopped me in the hallway, and they said, the casting directors, they said, we're doing this musical on Jackie Robinson. Do you mind if we submit you? And I just burst out laughing. I thought it was pretty, you know, ludicrous. But I got the part, and it worked, and I was on Broadway, and it flopped. And it was an incredible experience. It was an incredible, I experienced everything, like 10 minutes of fame, half an hour of failure, a lot of money, no money, everything within a six-month period. You know, it was all there. And it was great and scary and all that stuff. It was a pretty emotional period.
Was it hard for you to get roles because of being black? Did you go through Hollywood shuffle kinds of stereotype auditions?
I think we all did because we all came out around the period when Eddie Murphy was really making it big. So we all went through the audition of they want an Eddie Murphy type, you know. And so in that sense, yeah. And I always played for a while. I would get a lot of the, sidekick roles, you know. And so until this show came along, I was kind of at a crossroads. I felt like I always worked, but I didn't feel artistically or creatively challenged. And I remember driving home one day. I was making money and everything and living a good life. And I said, what am I? I mean, what do I do? Because when you do, like, guest episodes on sitcoms or soap opera or something that is just so inane, it just doesn't challenge you at all, then it's just a job, you know. And so it was pretty scary. I didn't know what I was, you know. And this show has changed all that.
So as someone who's played John's sidekick, what kind of sidekick roles did you get?
I was always like the partner. Like I was Gene Hackman's partner in Loose Cannons. I was I was another detective in this Paul Hogan movie, Almost an Angel. I was the best friend when, you know, the couple's making love. I was a guy like peeking through the window going, come on, man. You're going to be late for work, you know, stuff like that. countless movies I was, you know, best friend guy, you know, that kind of dude.
So what's a typical week like now on In Living Color when you're doing a new show?
Well, what we do is we come in on Monday or Tuesday. We have a read through. We sit around the table and we have a read through. And we read through every sketch that is a possibility. So usually it's really long. The read through will be 2 hours, 2.5 hours. We'll read through maybe 2 shows worth of material, usually 2.5 shows. And then we go away for lunch. And we come back, and already the editing has started. Sketches that don't fly at the reading are taken out. And we start from there. And then we put that sketch on its feet. And from there is a lot of time where the actors begin forming and melding it. You know, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't sound right. Let me try this. I have an idea. And we play. You know, I'm in a cast with a group of people that are so great and so insane. Everyone's friends. We sit around all day and we just act foolish and funny. And most of those characters come out of us waiting. When we're waiting around to rehearse or waiting for a rewrite and we start egging each other on, that's how the BS Brothers started. Because like other cast members would put us in situations and they make us do it. And a lot of that stuff is stuff that we find hilarious. You know, and we just do it all day, all night, and until finally someone says, we have to get that in a sketch.
What's it like being one of the actors who's not a weigh-ins on the show?
Man, it's hell. I'm getting my name changed. You know what? In a way, it's great and it's fun. You know, Keenan, I have to say this, is he has created such a wonderful working environment. He inspires us, he cajoles us, he pushes us to create. This is a show that you can never sit back and just go for the ride, or else you just get swallowed up. I mean, you always have to be there pushing, always have to be there writing, coming up with ideas, or saying, I want to do this, let me do this, and Keenan will let you, you know. And it's really a tribute to him. And since he, in a way, is like the patriarch because he's the oldest brother, you know, with Kim, sometimes they treat her like the little sister, you know what I mean? So she has to get past that whole thing. But I like not being a Wayans because I don't have to deal with that family dynamic, you know what I mean? I can
right.
just come in there and go, you know. But then again, like, you know, tickets to, like, the Grammys I don't get. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
Well, I love your work, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You can see David Alan Greer Sunday nights on In Living Color on Fox Television. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In January, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney canceled production of the A-12 bomber because of design problems and huge cost overruns. Now, with Cheney's approval, the Navy has resurrected the program under a new name. Coming up, we discuss this stealth fighter and its troubled history with journalist Tim Weiner, who has investigated the Pentagon's secret budget. Also, if you've written off singer Charlie Rich as a performer you're not interested in, rock historian Ed Ward says give him another try. Ed has a profile of the rockabilly singer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Iraqi government forces are continuing their advance into rebel areas in the north and south of the country, forcing hundreds of thousands of civilians to flee. The Iraqi army has retaken Samoa, the last town it held in the Shiite Muslim area of the south. Baghdad says its troops have also recaptured the town of Joa near the Turkish border. Kurdish rebel leaders concede they've lost control of two important northern cities. Gerald Butt filed this report for the BBC.
Overnight, Kurdish rebels said they withdrew from two major cities in northern Iraq, Duhok and Erbil, north and east of Mosul, because their forces were no match for the heavy weapons, armor, and helicopter gunships of the military. Since then, the Baghdad government has claimed the capture of Zaho, close to the northern border with Turkey. In Shiite Muslim areas of southern Iraq, it's a similar picture, with the city of Samawa the latest to be recaptured by the army. Iraqi opposition leaders are beginning to accept, reluctantly, that the month-long rebellion in the cities is being crushed, wiping out all the early successes chalked up by the dissidents. Saddam Hussein's army has proven itself to be in much better shape than many people imagined, enabling its vastly superior weaponry to devastate without mercy population centers controlled by the rebels.
The BBC's Gerald Butt. The Treasury Department today released a list of 89 companies and individuals it says are controlled by or for agents of Iraq. The government says doing business with these firms is the same as doing business with Saddam Hussein. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The government says the companies and individuals formed a network that helped Saddam build his military and gave him places to invest the money he skimmed from the state oil industry. That money has been estimated at $10 billion. Deputy Treasury Secretary John Robson wouldn't give a government estimate, but said what investigators have found so far is an iceberg.
The iceberg we found is 89 individuals and entities high, and we are still investigating the rest of it. In terms of the dollar aspect of it, I think I've indicated that we're simply not going to speculate on that at the moment.
The two American firms on the list are Bay Industries of Santa Monica and Matrix Churchill of Cleveland. Treasury agents seized Bay Industries last Friday. The government shut down Matrix Churchill in September. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Cuba has circulated 35 amendments to a U.S.-initiated Gulf War ceasefire proposal at the U.N. today. The amendments could stall adoption of the ceasefire draft resolution, which demands that Iraq destroy all of its dangerous weapons and pay war reparations. Diplomats say a few of the non-aligned countries on the Security Council support some of the changes, but not all of them. The Cuban suggestions would lift all sanctions against Iraq immediately. On Wall Street, the Dow fell 33 points to close at 2881.19. This is NPR. The Agency for International Development says a team of U.S. officials will travel to Albania on Wednesday to determine humanitarian needs there. This is the first-ever visit to Albania by a U.S. foreign aid team. The two countries reestablished diplomatic ties 2 weeks ago after a break of more than 50 years. The visit is in response to a request by Albanian Foreign Minister Mohamed Kapelani and leaders of the opposition Democratic Party. The Americans will look at medical and food needs. Albania is in the third year of a drought that has worsened food shortages. A Texas state judge today postponed action on a sweeping reorganization of public school funding. NPR's John Burnett reports.
The state failed to meet a court-ordered deadline this morning to devise a plan to balance funding between its rich and poor school districts. District Judge Scott McGowan gave the legislature an additional 2 weeks. To make sure it meets the new deadline, the judge appointed a courtmaster to fine-tune an alternate plan that would redistribute funds to the state's 1,054 independent school districts. Last week, the Texas House failed to pass a Senate-approved $14 billion school finance reform bill. Opponents called it a Robin Hood bill that took hundreds of millions of dollars in local property tax money from wealthy school districts and gave it to impoverished ones. Today's action technically shuts down all state funding to public schools, but it has no real effect since checks for April have already been sent out. State lawmakers missed a similar deadline last spring. In Austin, I'm John Burnett.
Citicorp, the parent of Citibank and the nation's largest credit card issuer, is now waging an aggressive campaign to get more customers to use its cards. It's offering customers price-matching rebate incentives. Customers who purchase certain goods with their Citibank Visa or MasterCard and who then see the same items advertised in print at a lower price will then be refunded the difference. The service will be offered free of charge. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It was big news last January when Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney scrapped plans for the A-12 Avenger, an ultra-high-tech stealth fighter. Cheney's reasons? Design problems and huge cost overruns. With its $93 billion price tag, the A-12 was the largest procurement project ever to be canceled by the Pentagon. Now Cheney has given the Navy approval to start the project again, but under a new name, the AX. The A-12 was funded under the Pentagon's top-secret budget known as the Black Budget. This budget is so secret, it's not subject to congressional oversight. In fact, critics say projects funded under the Black Budget have no accountability. The AX is also shrouded in the secrecy of this Black Budget. Tim Weiner won a Pulitzer Prize for his Philadelphia Inquirer series investigating the Black Budget. He's also the author of a book about it called Blank Check. We phoned Weiner at the Philadelphia Inquirer's Washington Bureau and asked him what the difference is between the proposed AX and the abandoned A-12.
A Navy commander I talked to said, well, we just threw it in the dryer and shrunk it a little bit. It'll be slightly less secret, perhaps just as costly, perhaps a little less stealthy, a little less elaborate.
Let me just get you to describe what kind of airplane this is.
Well, it's hard to say exactly because of the secrecy surrounding the program, but it was going to be a kind of a triangular wedge shape, an attack aircraft that would have been based on aircraft carriers and would have replaced the A-6, the mission of which was largely to destroy fixed targets and tanks in the Iraq War. It's going to be a very expensive, maybe $165 million a copy version of a $20 million existing plane.
The A-12 was part of the Black Budget, the secret budget, which means what?
Well, that means its costs and for a long time its existence were classified above top secret and hidden from the normal kind of oversight that Congress intends to impose on Pentagon spending.
Now, Dick Cheney said that the secrecy behind the building of this weapon kept information from him. Does the Secretary of Defense not have access to information in the Black Budget?
Well, what happened, this is what Cheney's own investigators, his inspectors general, told him. What happened was that the secrecy surrounding the program was allowed to overwhelm the normal channels by which bad news is supposed to filter up the chain of command. When people came in from outside and tried to take notes about problems in the program, General Dynamics and McDonnell Douglas confiscated the notes. When people tried to report that there were billion-dollar cost overruns on the first $2 billion of spending on this program, their remarks were classified and did not filter up, did not percolate up. Secrecy was allowed to overwhelm the normal kind of accountability that we want in government spending.
Now, the A-12 was contracted to General Dynamics Corporation and McDonnell Douglas. It looks like there's a possibility that the new AX will go to the same two contractors.
They have the inside track, and as Bob Costello, who used to be the procurement czar in the Pentagon, the man in charge of buying weapons, told me in an interview, who else is there? Nobody else can compete. There's a very small number of military contractors capable of undertaking these programs. And there was a real question a while back that if the Pentagon had enforced its claims against these companies, the Pentagon says they never delivered on $1.3 billion worth of work, that they might force the companies into bankruptcy reorganization. But these are, in the Pentagon's eyes, in the Navy's eyes, the best qualified, the best equipped companies to do it, even though their work on the A-12 is now under criminal investigation.
Well, weren't they accused of having secret cost overruns in the A-12?
In effect, yes, cost overruns that became part of the classified information on the plane.
So it's a strange situation to go back to the same people who were responsible for some of the problems in the first place.
Well, this may or may not happen, but folks I talk to in the Navy say that those companies do have the inside track.
Now, what happens to all the money and all the progress that was made on the A-12? The A-12 was scrapped. Now they're building a new plane that's basically the same plane, but it has a different name. Can they use anything that went into the production of the now-defunct A-12 to make the now-proposed AX?
Concepts, yes. But essentially, we lost $3 billion to a system of excessive secrecy.
But there's no way of rescuing any of that since they're trying...
Well, there is litigation looming over who owns the work product. There's litigation looming over recovering the costs. But basically, they're going to have to go back to the drawing board on this one.
My guest is Tim Weiner. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of a book on the Pentagon secret budget called Blank Check. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tim Weiner is my guest. Tim, you've been writing about the American Defense Department and our weapon systems for some time. During the war, you were able to see how some of these weapons performed, and that made them something less than abstractions, really. What surprised you most in watching how these weapons did?
Well, I think that the thing that surprised me the most was the tremendous array of force that the United States was able to bring to bear against Iraq. As Colin Powell said, I've got all the tools in my toolbox ready, and I brought them to the party, as he put it. The use of things that were really not acknowledged to be in the American arsenal, like fuel-air explosives, was astonishing. Great precision that was advertised by these weapons, I think, still remains to be confirmed. I think that we probably missed more targets than we hit, but we brought such an awesome amount of firepower to bear. Blowing up in 7 weeks, 50% more tonnage and bombs than we did during the 7-year bombing campaign in Vietnam. It was an absolutely stunning display of force.
Were there any conclusions you were able to make in watching the weapons perform about different eras of spending and development in the Pentagon?
Well, I think it is a myth that the tremendous triumph of American weapons technology in the Gulf War was a direct result of the spending buildup of the 1980s. To the contrary, the weapon systems that performed best, the F-117A stealth fighter, the Tomahawk cruise missiles, the tank-killing Warthog A-10 jets, were all built and funded in the 60s and 70s. And it is the weapon systems that are the great, significant military programs of the 1980s, such as the B-2 stealth bomber, the A-12 attack jet we've been talking about, and many, many others weren't in theater. They've barely come off the drawing board. So, for example, the B-2, despite $30 billion spent to date, exists as a theoretical plane at this point. Two have been built, and they remain untested. So I think the one of the lessons that we've learned is that our conventional strength is awesome and can be brought to bear against any enemy on this planet. But the extraordinary high-technology weapon systems like the stealth bomber, the Navy's stealth fighter, and many, many other systems that were developed in the 80s to fight the Soviet Union have served only to drain the treasury and cannot be fielded because the technological and financial challenges they pose have not been solved.
Did the weapons that performed best for us during the Gulf War, were they built under the secrecy provided by the black budget?
With one exception, and that is the F-117A stealth fighter, no, all of them were built openly.
And why is that? Was it before the black budget was created?
No, the black budget's been around ever since the Cold War began in the late 1940s. It is simply that the number of weapons programs and the cost of those weapons programs built under the black budget simply exploded under the Reagan administration. And most of the weapons we fielded in the theater of war out there were created, funded, built in the 1970s.
So what are you watching most closely now in terms of the impact of the war on the future of American weapon systems?
Well, we are caught, if you'll pardon this terrible overused pun, between Iraq and a hard place. We have to get defense spending down in this country. The defense secretary says so. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell, says so. And we don't know how to do it intelligently. We're going to have to make choices between cutting major weapons programs like the B-2, choices that will throw thousands of people out of work in the defense industry, or throwing tens of thousands, perhaps 100,000 or more, soldiers out of work. And the alternative, which is allowing the defense budget to grow, is that we spend ourselves into weakness. It is a terrible dilemma. It seems incongruous to talk about it in these terms after such a smashing victory. But that is what lies ahead of us, and no one seems to know how to do this.
Tim Weiner, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Terry.
Tim Weiner is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the author of Blank Check about the Pentagon's secret budget. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. A communist victory as expected in the elections in Albania, but the opposition party, the Democratic Party, did quite well, especially in the larger cities. In Soviet Georgia, an overwhelming vote for independence there, but there's new concern about ethnic violence in one region of Georgia. We'll be talking with Verlin Klinkenborg. He's the author of The Last Fine Time, a book about a Polish bar in a Polish neighborhood in Buffalo, New York. Also, our series about family life in America begins, on All Things Considered, with conversations among four single mothers at their weekly poker game in an apartment in New York City.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rockabilly music is often described as a fusion of blues and country music, but one singer has specialized in blending those two elements with a jazz sensibility. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says it's too bad Charlie Rich is best known for his weepy country-politan hits of the early and mid-70s, because there's a lot more to him than that.
Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? And if you did, was she crying, crying? Hey.
It's too bad that when most people hear the name Charlie Rich, they think of his huge 1973 number one hit,
the most beautiful girl, and the subsequent PR campaign that called him the Silver Fox. Not that Charlie Rich didn't deserve the success, nor that he should have dyed his hair or something. It's just that there's a lot more to him than that. He was born in 1932 in rural Arkansas, in a town called Colt, but being a good student, he managed to escape and wound up at the University of Arkansas. He joined the Air Force and married a remarkable woman named Margaret Ann, who shared his passion for jazz and who sang in the group he put together to play on weekends, the Velvetones. But Charlie was a realist, so when he left the Air Force, he took up chicken farming. He'd never make any money with music, especially since he was neither a country nor a rock and roll performer. Margaret Ann, though, believed in him, and on her advice, he went to Memphis to audition for Sun Records. They set him to work playing piano on Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison records, and there he caught the ear of the studio bandleader, Bill Justice. Justice helped Charlie arrange some songs, and although their first couple of tries failed, the third was the charm.
Well, I make it all right. Well, I make it all right. From Monday morning to Friday night. Since you left me,
since you left me,
I'm as lonely as I can be.
Oh, those lonely weekends.
Said you'd be
ooh,
good to me.
Ooh, wow, wow.
Said our love
ooh, wow,
would never die.
Ooh, wow, wow.
Said you'd be
ooh, wow,
good to me.
Ooh, wow, wow.
But baby,
in those first sessions, there was also a song that was uncomfortably close to the truth.
I got loaded last night on a bottle of gin. And I had a fight with my best girlfriend. But when I'm drinking, I am no. But please, baby, wait for me until they let me out again.
For the moment, things were going well for Charlie. He followed Bill Justice out of the ruins of Sun and across town to the High label, where he recorded a soulful country and western album that went nowhere. Undaunted, the pair went to RCA's newly formed Groove label, and the music they made caused a buzz in the record industry.
Cut out your dancing, never see a show. Friends come by to pick you up, but you hardly ever go. Seems your head is in the clouds above. You've got the way of a woman in love.
Unfortunately, Groove fell apart just about this time, so nobody ever heard this stuff. But Justice and Rich fled over to the Smash label, and there they started out right with a song that was just the sort of thing Charlie did best. Considering that it was 1965 and Charlie, with his head of prematurely white hair, wasn't exactly teen dream material, Mohair Sam did just fine. He followed it up with an album, Many New Sides of Charlie Rich, that's an American pop masterpiece, featuring great songs Charlie had written and a couple by Margaret Ann, who contributed this rock and roll classic.
Once I had a diamond ring, but I
And then nothing. 5 years of nothing, unless you call chicken farming something. Part of it was Charlie's fault. He wasn't real good at compromise, and he was getting a reputation as being hard to work with. Part of it was the changing taste of the record-buying public. Finally, in 1970, Billy Sherrill, the man behind Tammy Wynette's hits, started producing Charlie for Epic Records, first with a song called July 12, 1939, that sounded too much like Ode to Billy Joe, and eventually winding up with that number one crossover country-to-pop hit, The Most Beautiful Girl. But Sherrill is something of a tyrant in the studio, and Charlie felt that he was being asked to compromise again. He continued to record through the mid-70s, then faded away. Still, he left another masterpiece in the form of a song he'd written, inspired by the title of a 1971 book by Peter Guralnick, which included a profile of Charlie that took him seriously, on his own terms. It's the kind of song that's hard to listen to because it's so honest.
Lord, I feel like going home. I tried and I failed, and I'm tired and weary. And everything I done was wrong. Feel like going home. Lord, I tried to see it through. But it was too for me. And now I'm coming home to you. I feel like going home.
Charlie Rich is still out there, performing very rarely. Maybe someday the public will catch up to him.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Ron Barron, and Audrey Voblaitis. Directing honors shared today by Chris Bergen and Roberta Sherrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, life in America's housing projects. We talk with journalist Alex Kotlowitz, the author of a new book that follows one family in one of Chicago's projects, and journalist Barry Michael Cooper, who co-wrote the screenplay for New Jack City. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.